Sarah Kanoski here. Each and every crime has a story behind it.
I was asleep and then I felt this really intense burning.
On Conversations, I've met ex-criminals, detectives, crime reporters, victims of crime, and the wrongfully accused.
More grenades start coming in and then I hear from a loudspeaker that it's the police.
Search for the Conversations True Crime Collection on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Annabelle here. If you're loving the stories of Australia's oldest library, why don't you join me and a special collection of librarians, Richard Neville, Margot Riley, and Damien Webb. And between the four of us, we'll be blowing the dust off more fascinating stories and quietly debating whether this is history or just exceptionally well-catalogued hoarding. That's History or Hoarding live at the State Library of New South Wales Auditorium, Tuesday, May 26, from 6 p.m. Booking link in the show notes and on the State Library of New South Wales website. And now, here's the next episode. Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Welcome back to History or Hoarding. If you look around your life, most of the stuff you hold on to, you know, the stuff you carry with you through every house move, you can't quite bring yourself to dispose of, even though you actively never use it. It's probably pretty low security gear on the whole. I mean, no burglar is going to touch your high school yearbook or the wonky pinch pot your kid made for you at kindy. But what about the stuff that you hide somewhere safe? The stuff you don't want anyone to find? Everyone has stuff that we squirrel away and what insurance companies routinely warn us are really, really obvious and dumb places, like under mattresses and in undie drawers. Look, a confession, I once went on holiday and I hid my laptop in the oven, which worked perfectly well burglary-wise, but I did accidentally bake it on my return, having completely forgotten it was there. Anyway, there are two types of stuff, I think, that we hide in these secure places. First of all, valuables, granny's engagement ring, cash, maybe an expensive watch if you have one. But there's other stuff we hide away too. Stuff we'd be ashamed for wandering eyes to see. Stuff we want to keep a secret. From porn stashes to love letters to embarrassing old photos, lots of us hide certain things not because we want to protect the things from robbers, but because we want to protect others and ourselves from the things. And guess what? Libraries are exactly the same. Deep down in the earth, under the State Library of New South Wales sandstone building in Sydney's CBD, is the locked fortress where valuable things and shameful things live cheek by jowl, where priceless artefacts of the nation's pride and achievement lie peacefully on ordered shelves next to its dirty, smelly secrets. They call it the strong room, and trust me, it's strong. No one's allowed to enter this room alone. I am literally not allowed to describe the process of getting into the strong room, but suffice to say it involves multiple steps, multiple librarians, and puts me irresistibly in mind of a Victorian-era quadrille, which is kind of appropriate because today's story dates back to that exact period, specifically the 1890s, when widowed Victoria sat on the British throne and faraway Sydney was lit by gas lamps and racked by economic hard times. Shanty towns and grifters sprang up in equal measure. The New South Wales police force numbered nearly 2,000 officers, but only a tiny handful achieved the elevated rank of detective. And in 1892, that elite brotherhood admitted a new member, Detective Jules P. Rocher. Rocher was a French immigrant, and he was initially hired because his language skills were invaluable in tracking down escaped convicts from New Caledonia. But Rocher quickly assumed a rather energetic role as a guardian of public morals, a kind of Antipodean Eliot Ness, maybe. He declared war on anarchists and pimps, He busted open a trafficking racket, Sydney girls sent unwittingly to be sex workers in Noumea. He was described as a bloodhound of society. Annoyed anarchists condemned him as a member of the secret police. And he joined enthusiastically in the pursuit of that other detested source of 19th century depravity, homosexuals, specifically in the inner city, where Wynyard was a known beat.
So this is in 1893, and so this area in Wynyard was well known as a place where homosexual men would come and meet in the hotel.
In one particular raid on a cheap Wynyard hotel, Rocher and his colleagues seized a cache of letters. By 19th century standards, these letters were utterly shocking. They were explicit, fond correspondence between men who physically desired and missed each other. Detective Rocher grabs the letters. But he doesn't hand them in at the station. Why? We don't know. All we know is that he was aware of their significance. He kept them for decades, and when he was close to death, in 1919, he made a decision.
And he writes a letter to the library and he says, "You need to send someone to my house. I have something that you need for the collection. Do not send a woman."
Gracious.
The contents of these letters are too shocking for a lady. And so someone goes and collects the letters and brings them back.
And locks them away with the rest of the rude stuff. Rocher's packet of racy letters slumbers away in the library's collection for generations, unopened, unread. No threat to the city's moral safety. And that's the way things stayed for nearly 100 years, until one of the library's very particular curators went on a detective mission of her own.
Well, my name is Margot Riley, and I'm a curator in the Collection Acquisition and Curation branch at the State Library. I have been at the library nearly 30 years. I came for 2 weeks, and here I am 30 years later.
Margot started out as a historian of fashion, and she's always perfectly turned out. You can't miss her. She only ever wears navy blue. And Margot, in her own way, is every bit as much of a bloodhound as Detective Rocher was. She loves going on exploratory missions into the library's vast and uncharted collection. She's developed almost a sixth sense for finding stuff. She calls it berry picking.
So that idea of sort of wandering around, seeing a berry bush and picking off a berry, looking over there, seeing another berry, you know, follow a clue.
In a library with 6 million items, the berry bushes can seem endless, indistinguishable one from another. So Margot uses new tools, search terms in the digitised catalogue, but also old ones to help her uncover juicy finds in the stacks.
I love catalogue cards. Oh, I have a deep passion for catalogue cards. Because apart from anything else, you almost get a sense of the person who wrote the catalogue card.
Oh, yeah.
The handwriting.
Yeah.
And there was this one particular handwriting. I'm like, it's always a goodie when I see that handwriting.
Wow. And who is the owner of that handwriting?
I don't know.
Okay, so but what sort of vintage is it?
Oh, I mean, early, I'd
quill?
Say.
A bit quilly?
No, well, it's fountain pen.
Back when people had nice handwriting.
Definitely fountain pen-ish.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, that probably first, you know, 1900 through to, and it feels like a feminine hand.
Do you have a nickname for her?
We had several Idas, and I often think of her as an Ida, but I don't know for sure, so I don't like to.
So what is it about her catalogue cards? What makes them so great?
Look, it's totally rational. There's nothing... I just would be, oh, wow, there's her handwriting, and it would make me look deeper.
This story about Margot and her long-dead colleague, it's actually really important because cataloguing and the keywords a librarian picks out when filing something is a really long-tail business. Sometimes those catalogue cards written generations ago in an elegant hand by anonymous predecessors, long dead now, are the reason an item gets picked up and looked at further. For any one item, The catalogue description determines whether it gets lost among the library's vast and never-ending collection or whether it gets found.
Yeah, tracking acquisition information comes through cards and files, which we love.
The letters in the Rocher envelope, though, were restricted. They were kept locked away. But in the 2010s, the library embarked on an ambitious project to digitise its catalogue and revise the terms under which each item had been originally stored. And one day, not long after that, in 2011, Margot Riley went berry picking. It was 4:30 p.m. on a Friday. Because that is...
That's a magic hour.
Right? Now, Margot actually has an established habit of stumbling upon incredible things at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, just before it's time to clock off for the weekend.
I don't know what it... I think, you know, it's that always the, oh, just, I'll do half, you know, just half an hour before the end of the day kind of thing. So you often can do, like, just a random search. You just think, oh, what can I do to help me get ready for the next week, you know? I'll just... you know, surf around.
It's right, and just treat yourself to a little...
a bit of a surf.
Run it up the flagpole.
See what comes. See what happens.
And then sometimes good things come.
Often. A lot.
And so, of course, it was at this exact time...
Friday afternoon.
...when Margot stumbled across one of the most exciting berries of her career. A previously restricted and homoerotic berry.
I had been asked to do a talk, and it was for Mardi Gras, and it was for a queer thinking seminar that they used to run. And so I typed the word homosexuality into the library's catalogue.
Okay.
I'd never done that before. And up popped this reference.
And the reference was to some intimate letters between a man of whom Margot had never heard.
A young man called Maurice Schwab.
And another man called Lord Alfred Douglas.
His nickname was Bosie.
Yep. Now that second name is one Margot definitely recognised.
I had recently read the biography of Lord Alfred Douglas,
right,
the lover of Oscar Wilde.
Bosie was a key figure in the most famous trial in English literature, the defamation trial that destroyed Oscar Wilde, sent him to prison and to an early death. A quick refresher on the Oscar Wilde scandal for anyone who's forgotten the details. In 1895, Oscar Wilde was at the absolute peak of his fame. His most celebrated play, The Importance of Being Earnest, had just premiered. Wilde, who was married to a woman and had two children, for much of his life had male lovers, and one of them, Wilde's great love, was Lord Alfred Douglas, Bosie. He was an aristocrat and a poet who coined the phrase, the love that dare not speak its name. They were mad for each other. Bosie's father, however, the 9th Marquess of Queensberry, was much less enthusiastic about the arrangement. In fact, so determined was the Marquess to break the relationship up that he called Wilde out publicly and accused him of being gay. At the time, this was a deeply defamatory thing to say. Wilde sued his boyfriend's father for libel, which was a bold move, given the central allegation was indeed true. History, of course, records that this decision turned into a spectacular own goal. Queensberry's lawyers tracked down working-class young men Wilde had been involved with, rent boys, valets, street hustlers, and coerced them into testifying. The evidence piled up, and Wilde found himself convicted of gross indecency. Sentenced to 2 years hard labour, he came out of prison completely broken, health ruined, reputation destroyed, and his wife and kids nowhere to be seen. He spent the last 3 years of his life in exile in France, penniless, and writing almost nothing more, before dying at 46.
So I immediately, it was again, it was like 4:30 on a Friday afternoon.
And so Margot, back in the library in 2011, having just read Lord Alfred Douglas's biography, was incredulous.
So I'm reading and I'm like, hang on a minute. And it's saying that there are letters written by Bosie,
yeah,
and that they are in the library's collection.
She beetled straight down to the strong room to see if this brief cataloguing note could possibly be accurate.
I just said to a colleague, we're going to the safe, because they were in the safe. We go down to the safe and we open them up and we're like, oh my God, these are not just, you know, hope you're doing well and hope you had a nice trip.
Right.
It's actually love letters from one man to another.
The love letters, the gay love letters. So these are the letters that I came across on one of my berry picking exercises on a Friday afternoon when I was doing some research.
So Margot showed us some of these letters. They're all signed by Lord Alfred Douglas, Bosie.
So he says, from your loving boy wife, Bosie. And these are being sent to a man by the name of Maurice Schwabe. I thought, who is he? So I typed the name into Google, as we do, and up popped this amazing photograph.
Beautiful photograph is of a man in a three-piece suit sitting down with a tie and one of those sort of fabulous flip
tall top collar, yes.
Tall collars. High collar. Mm. And sitting on his knee is another man similarly dressed, white tie. Both of them are wearing these elaborate buttonholes.
I think also that's lovely about this is the carnations.
Back then, the carnation was a flower of particular carnal significance. A man wearing one could be assumed to have a sexual interest in other men.
And Oscar Wilde would always wear a green carnation in his buttonhole.
And the second man is looking with great affection and tenderness. There's a real intimacy into the eyes of the man on whose knee he's sitting, and they are holding hands.
What an extraordinary photograph to have two men sitting this way in a photography studio in the 19th century.
That's
because, apart from anything else, when you had a portrait taken in the 19th century, you never touched it unless you were related or, you know, in a relationship. That's what it meant.
So these two men, Maurice Schwabe and Lord Alfred Douglas, were deeply in love. And actually, both were very connected to Oscar Wilde's sensational trial, because Schwabe was the one who introduced Wilde to a lot of those sex workers and young men who then gave evidence against him in court. So Schwabe is kind of this crucial puzzle piece in Oscar Wilde's downfall. But his name was never actually said out loud in court. Maurice Schwabe's name and his whole role in the story was covered up by his influential family.
Schwabe's uncle was the prosecutor for the case.
No.
So he was given the, you know, get out of town. So his family sent him away.
So the letters the library has, they're basically following Maurice Schwabe as he moves away from England towards Australia by ship to escape the trial.
And so Bosie, who's living in Salisbury at the family pile, has found out that Maurice has left, and so he's writing these to him, and he's heartbroken because they're being separated.
It's pretty rare to have a candid surviving account like that. Most people in Wilde's circles would have burned any correspondence that could have signalled they too were gay. So the existence of these letters, just the survival of them, is remarkable.
And the language, he calls him my darling pretty. He talks about a bangle, that he's sent him a bangle because he wants him to have this love token that he will have on his body to link them together. And it really just, talks about his family, to how his brother, how, you know, everybody's trying to keep them apart. So all of that is alluded to in these letters, including the fact that they, Bosie and Maurice, had spent time together in the Savoy Hotel, which is also where Oscar Wilde had been with sex workers. But he talks about their time together, saying how, you know, they're our special room, you know, where we had, you know, wonderful, lovely times together.
The package of letters also contains some from Schwabe's mum.
And basically the indication is that he was, at some point, had said that he was going to train to be a priest, and that, you know, the idea was that he would come to the colonies, his past would be obliterated and he could, you know, clean up his act. But he has then contacted his family, and as the mother says, fear much that you have again fallen in with bad companions in Sydney.
She's not so much angry,
as disappointed. My dear Maurice, it's difficult to write to you as I feel that if I reproach you, you'll simply leave the letter unread.
Yeah.
Fair. But the family's plan to send him away to protect him, well, it worked.
He was not really implicated in the whole wild affair. So he didn't go to jail. He wasn't prosecuted. So he had been protected. Schwabe eventually went back to Europe.
But his letters, they didn't follow him back. Because while he was in Australia...
He's living in a hotel in Wynyard.
The very same hotel that our bloodhound detective Jules Rocher was surveilling.
And at some point they raided the room and they found the letters.
Whoa. Rocher knew enough about the letters to know that they were significant, but enough too to know that they should never be seen.
And literally they're in the same envelope that the detective had stored them all these years. No, I don't think anyone else had probably looked at them until I came across them and you know, read them. And it was just extraordinary.
Just about a century elapsed between Rocher's retirement from the Moral Decency Patrol and Margot's casual search term, looking for material for Mardi Gras, an event that would no doubt have horrified the detective. Those letters remained exactly the same, secured under lock and key, in the same envelope. But over that century, they went from being shameful obscenities to literary treasures. The letters didn't change, but we did.
A story has been told in different ways over time, using different mechanisms. So there's often just new little nuances or new aspects. A story being told by a different person always gives a different lens to it.
Why did Rocher hold on to these letters in his own home? I must say this is something I've noticed when looking at the history of institutions guarding citizens from moral depravity. Seems to be a bit of a tendency sometimes for the authority figure to retain very close custody of the horrific material in question. Librarian Maggie Patton explains that this is actually a thing.
Absolutely. And through through different periods, different librarians had a different attitude to this sort of material. So before we had the strong room, back in the 20s and 30s, there was things in the librarian's office. And their call number began with L.
Oh.
And so we know anything that used to have a call number L, and we still do have some, and I'll show you some later on, they were kept in the librarian's office. So people would actually have to ask the librarian before they were issued.
I love it. This is so filthy that it's going to have to live in my office where I can just directly supervise it and occasionally check that it's exactly as filthy as I think it is.
And just, I think it was last year, we were moving some furniture around in what was the librarian's office.
Yeah.
And in the bottom of the cabinet there was a drawer, and we opened the drawer and in it was a whole lot of stuff that had been sitting there since the 1960s, and for some reason no one had opened it and it hasn't been catalogued on the online catalogue. So this is all this stuff that people thought was too racy.
The library is constantly rearranging its furniture and its standards of rudeness. This goes back to its very earliest days as a public institution.
Well, they were very wary of fiction. There was a sense of fiction, popular fiction, was really a bit troubling.
This is Richard Neville, Mitchell librarian. He explains that the library's historic role as a censor hasn't just been restricted to gay smut. For a brief but very judgmental period, for instance, the library disapproved of fiction.
Because a lot of libraries, particularly in the 19th century, were focused on the working classes and this idea of self-improvement.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking for people who could actually come into the library and improve themselves, go out and become better citizens, vote more intelligently, not beat their wives. And so libraries were very down on fiction, didn't believe that popular fiction was appropriate because it was kind of a bit like social media, trashy and rot your mind kind of thing. Maids would read popular fiction, and you didn't want your kind of children reading what your maids were reading and so on.
And when the library was sold to the government in 1869 and became a public institution, some pretty drastic measures were taken to protect
gentle readers.
In fact, the first thing they did was actually get rid of the fiction, the popular fiction.
Oh, so what happened to the fiction? Did they just landfill? Did they burn it?
No. Well, they gave it to what was then to two institutions, Sydney Hospital, which was kind of right next door, and also to the Gladesville Psychiatric Hospital. And
sorry, what?
The Gladesville Psychiatric Hospital. So they got the novels as well.
They fed the fiction
to people who they thought were insane. Okay. Anyway, it was seen as a very generous gesture.
I'm just picturing the scene when the, you know, when the horse and cart backs up at the Gladesville Hospital for the Criminally Insane or whatever it's called, and out pours this sort of stack of novels.
Yeah, it was about 2,000 novels went to them.
But there was one piece of tidying up. The library contemplated seriously. That was a real doozy. It was about protecting the people of New South Wales from the shame of their convict past.
But we almost got rid of all the convict records. I don't know if anyone's told you this
story yet.
Oh, my God, they were the biggest source of shame.
This is Damien Webb, manager of the Indigenous Engagement Branch.
Absolutely. Like, we used to have special warnings around it. The shame people felt if they found out that they were not actually...
Really?
...old money in Australia and were actually descended from convicts. It was an absolute source of shame. The library openly discussed whether to even just destroy them all.
So you're telling me that in early days it was felt that people needed to be protected from painful revelations about their ancestors?
Yeah, or from other people being able to be like, you're actually descended from convicts, your granddad was a thief,
okay.
Which I assume is what was happening.
But times change, people change, and our idea of what is shameful changes too. By the time of the Bicentenary in 1988, being able to identify as the descendant of a convict had acquired something of a rakish edge. Thank goodness the library didn't destroy this stuff. Hey.
And obviously we kept it because keeping it's more important than not. And now it is this incredible point of pride.
Maybe that's the historical imperative of holding on to stuff, collecting shameful things as well as the things of which we're proudest. First, because it's kind of dishonest not to, but also because sometimes shame lifts over the years. And the gear we used to hide away comes out of the closet and we realise it's actually kind of precious and fascinating. Now, it's impossible to know if this noble philosophy is what Jules P. Rocher, the bloodhound detective, had in mind when he held on to that envelope of dirty letters all those years ago. Let's pretend it was. Monsieur, you were a fine detective, but you were an even better librarian. Next time, we meet two people hugely responsible for changing an institution's mind. The library's first Indigenous librarians, Melissa and Ronald. At the library, people call them the Giggle Twins. They started on the same day more than three decades ago, and they've revolutionised the way this library listens to First Nations stories.
Your proper library etiquette is to, you know, remain quiet and, you know, in hushed tones and all that sort of stuff. But here we are, two little black fellas, you know, from the bush. We'd be laughing and you know, and say, oh, Auntie Glennis, look, you know. But that was just how we wanted it to be. Mm. And because we were in totally new roles, so we were making it up as we were going along.
History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea. Harvey O'Sullivan is our audio engineer. Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer. And Carmel Rooney is our executive producer.